is the preliminary to its equally sudden contraction. The latter again evokes the former, but the former is impossible without disposable human material, without an increase in the number of labourers independently of the absolute growth of the population. This increase is effected by the simple process that constantly sets free a part of the labourers, by methods which lessen the number of labourers employed in proportion to the increased production. The whole form of the movement of modern industry depends, therefore, upon the constant transformation of a part of the labouring population into unemployed or half-employed hands. The superficiality of political economy shows itself in the fact that it looks upon the expansion and contraction of credit, which is a mere symptom of the periodic changes of the industrial cycle, as their cause. As the heavenly bodies, once thrown into a certain definite motion, always repeat this, so is it with social production. As soon as it is once thrown into this movement of alternate expansion and contraction, effects, in their turn, become causes, and the varying accidents of the whole process, which always reproduces its own conditions, take on the form of periodicity. When this periodicity is once consolidated, even political economy then sees that the production of a relative surplus population, that is, surplus with regard to the average needs of the self-expansion of capital, is a necessary condition of modern industry. Suppose, says H. Merivale, formerly Professor of Political Economy at Oxford, subsequently employed in the English Colonial Office, suppose that, on the occasion of some of these crises, the nation were to rouse itself to the effort of getting rid by emigration of some hundreds of thousands of superfluous arms, what would be the consequence? That, at the first returning demand for labour, there would be a deficiency. However rapid reproduction may be, it takes at all events the space of a generation to replace the loss of adult labour. Now the profits of our manufacturers depend mainly on the power of making use of the prosperous moment, when demand is brisk, and thus compensating themselves for the interval during which it is slack. This power is secured to them only by the command of machinery and of manual labour. They must have hands ready by them. They must be able to increase the activity of their operations when required, and to slacken it again, according to the state of the market, or they cannot possibly maintain that preeminence in the race of competition on which the wealth of the country is founded. Footnote. H. Merivale, Lectures on Colonization and Colonies, 1841. End of footnote. Even Malthus recognizes overpopulation as a necessity of modern industry, though, after his narrow fashion, he explains it by the absolute overgrowth of the labouring population, not by their becoming relatively supernumerary. He says, "Prudential habits with regard to marriage, carried to a considerable extent among the labouring class of a country mainly depending upon manufactures and commerce, might injure it. From the nature of a population, an increase of labourers cannot be brought into market in consequence of a particular demand till after the lapse of 16 or 18 years, and the conversion of revenue into capital, by saving, may take place much more rapidly. A country is always liable to an increase in the quantity of the funds for the maintenance of labour faster than the increase of population." Footnote. Malthus, Principles of Political Economy. In this work, Malthus finally discovers, with the help of Sismondi, the beautiful trinity of capitalistic production. Overproduction, overpopulation, overconsumption. Three very delicate monsters indeed. Cf. F. Engels, Umrisse zu einer Kritik der Nationalökonomie. End of footnote. After political economy has thus demonstrated the constant production of a relative surplus population of labourers to be a necessity of capitalistic accumulation, she very aptly, in the guise of an old maid, puts in the mouth of her beau ideal of a capitalist the following words addressed to those supernumeraries thrown on the streets by their own creation of additional capital. We manufacturers do what we can for you, whilst we are increasing that capital on which you must subsist, and you must do the rest by accommodating your numbers to the means of subsistence. Footnote. Harriet Martineau, A Manchester Strike, 1832. End of footnote. Capitalist production can by no means content itself with the quantity of disposable labour power which the natural increase of population yields. It requires, for its free play, an industrial reserve army independent of these natural limits. Up to this point, it has been assumed that the increase or diminution of the variable capital corresponds rigidly with the increase or diminution of the number of labourers employed. The number of labourers commanded by capital may remain the same or even fall, while the variable capital increases. This is the case if the individual labourer yields more labour and therefore his wages increase, and this although the price of labour remains the same or even falls, only more slowly than the mass of labour rises. Increase of variable capital, in this case, becomes an index of more labour, but not of more labourers employed. It is the absolute interest of every capitalist to press a given quantity of labour out of a smaller rather than a greater number of labourers, if the cost is about the same. In the latter case, the outlay of constant capital increases in proportion to the mass of labour set in action. In the former, that increase is much smaller. The more extended the scale of production, the stronger this motive. Its force increases with the accumulation of capital. We have seen that the development of the capitalist mode of production and of the productive power of labour, at once the cause and effect of accumulation, enables the capitalist, with the same outlay of variable capital, to set in action more labour by greater exploitation, extensive or intensive, of each individual labour power. We have further seen that the capitalist buys with the same capital a greater mass of labour power as he progressively replaces skilled labourers by less skilled, mature labour power by immature, male by female, that of adults by that of young persons or children. On the one hand, therefore, with the progress of accumulation, a larger variable capital sets more labour in action without enlisting more labourers. On the other, a variable capital of the same magnitude sets in action more labour with the same mass of labour power. And finally, a greater number of inferior labour powers by displacement of higher. The production of a relative surplus population, or the setting free of labourers, goes on, therefore, yet more rapidly than the technical revolution of the process of production that accompanies, and is accelerated by, the advance of accumulation, and more rapidly than the corresponding diminution of the variable part of capital as compared with the constant. If the means of production, as they increase in extent and effective power, become to a less extent means of employment of labourers, this state of things is again modified by the fact that in proportion as the productiveness of labour increases, capital increases its supply of labour more quickly than its demand for labourers. The overwork of the employed part of the working class swells the ranks of the reserve, whilst conversely, the greater pressure that the latter by its competition exerts on the former forces these to submit to overwork and to subjugation under the dictates of capital. The condemnation of one part of the working class to enforced idleness by the overwork of the other part, and the converse, becomes a means of enriching the individual capitalists and accelerates at the same time the production of the industrial reserve army on a scale corresponding with the advance of social accumulation. Footnote. Even in the cotton famine of 1863, we find in a pamphlet of the operative cotton spinners of Blackburn fierce denunciations of overwork, which, in consequence of the factory acts, of course only affected adult male labourers. The adult operatives at this mill have been asked to work from 12 to 13 hours per day, while there are hundreds who are compelled to be idle, who would willingly work partial time in order to maintain their families and save their brethren from a premature grave through being overworked. We, it goes on to say, would ask if the practice of working overtime by a number of hands is likely to create a good feeling between masters and servants. Those who are worked overtime feel the injustice equally with those who are condemned to forced idleness. There is in the district almost sufficient work to give to all partial employment, if fairly distributed. We are only asking what is right in requesting the masters generally to pursue a system of short hours, particularly until a better state of things begins to dawn upon us, rather than to work a portion of the hands overtime, while others, for want of work, are compelled to exist upon charity. Reports of the Inspector of Factories, October 31, 1863. The author of the Essay on Trade and Commerce grasps the effect of a relative surplus population on the employed labourers with his usual unerring bourgeois instinct. Another cause of idleness in this kingdom is the want of a sufficient number of labouring hands. Whenever, from an extraordinary demand for manufacturers, labour grows scarce, the labourers feel their own consequence, and will make their masters feel it likewise. It is amazing. But so depraved are the dispositions of these people that in such cases a set of workmen have combined to distress the employer by idling a whole day together. Essay, etc. The fellows, in fact, were hankering after a rise in wages. End of footnote. How important is this element in the formation of the relative surplus population is shown by the example of England. Her technical means for saving labour are colossal. Nevertheless, if tomorrow morning labour generally were reduced to a rational amount and proportioned to the different sections of the working class according to age and sex, the working population to hand would be absolutely insufficient for the carrying on of national production on its present scale. The great majority of the labourers now unproductive would have to be turned into productive ones. Taking them as a whole, the general movements of wages are exclusively regulated by the expansion and contraction of the industrial reserve army, and these again correspond to the periodic changes of the industrial cycle. They are, therefore, not determined by the variations of the absolute number of the working population, but by the varying proportions in which the working class is divided into active and reserve army, by the increase or diminution in the relative amount of the surplus population, by the extent to which it is now absorbed, now set free. For modern industry, with its decennial cycles and periodic phases, which, moreover, as accumulation advances, are complicated by irregular oscillations following each other more and more quickly, that would indeed be a beautiful law which pretends to make the action of capital dependent on the absolute variation of the population, instead of regulating the demand and supply of labour by the alternate expansion and contraction of capital. The labour market now appearing relatively underfull, because capital is expanding, now again overfull, because it is contracting. Yet, this is the dogma of the economists. According to them, wages rise in consequence of accumulation of capital. The higher wages stimulate the working population to more rapid multiplication, and this goes on until the labour market becomes too full, and therefore capital, relatively to the supply of labour, becomes insufficient. Wages fall, and now we have the reverse of the medal. The working population is little by little decimated as the result of the fall in wages, so that capital is again in excess relatively to them. Or, as others explain it, falling wages and the corresponding increase in the exploitation of the labourer again accelerates accumulation, whilst at the same time the lower wages hold the increase of the working class in check. Then comes again the time when the supply of labour is less than the demand, wages rise, and so on. A beautiful mode of motion, this, for developed capitalist production. Before, in consequence of the rise of wages, any positive increase of the population really fit for work could occur, the time would have been passed again and again, during which the industrial campaign must have been carried through, the battle fought and won. Between 1849 and 1859, a rise of wages, practically insignificant, though accompanied by falling prices of corn, took place in the English agricultural districts. In Wiltshire, for example, the weekly wages rose from 7 shillings to 8 shillings, in Dorsetshire from 7 shillings or 8 shillings to 9 shillings, etc. This was the result of an unusual exodus of the agricultural surplus population caused by the demands of war, the vast extension of railroads, factories, mines, etc. The lower the wages, the higher is the proportion in which ever so insignificant a rise of them expresses itself. If the weekly wage, for example, is 20 shillings, and it rises to 22 shillings, that is a rise of 10%. But if it is only 7 shillings, and it rises to 9 shillings, that is a rise of 28.47%, which sounds very fine. Everywhere the farmers were howling, and the London Economist, with reference to these starvation wages, prattled quite seriously of a generous and substantial advance. Footnote. Economist, January 21st, 1860. End of footnote. What did the farmers do now? Did they wait until, in consequence of this brilliant remuneration, the agricultural labourers had so increased and multiplied that their wages must fall again, as prescribed by the dogmatic economic brain? They introduced more machinery, and in a moment the labourers were redundant again, in a proportion satisfactory even to the farmers. There was now more capital laid out in agriculture than before, and in a more productive form. With this, the demand for labour fell, not only relatively, but absolutely. The above economic fiction confuses the laws that regulate the general movement of wages, or the ratio between the working class, that is, the total labour power, and the total social capital, with the laws that distribute the working population over the different spheres of production. If, for example, in consequence of favourable circumstances, accumulation in a particular sphere of production becomes especially active, and profits in it, being greater than the average profits, attract additional capital, of course the demand for labour rises and the wages also rise. The higher wages draw a larger part of the working population into the more favoured sphere, until it is glutted with labour power, and wages at length fall again to their average level, or below it, if the pressure is too great. Then, not only does the immigration of labourers into the branch of industry in question cease, it gives place to their emigration. Here the political economist thinks he sees the why and wherefore of an absolute increase of workers accompanying an increase of wages, and of a diminution of wages accompanying an absolute increase of labourers. But he sees really only the local oscillation of the labour market in a particular sphere of production. He sees only the phenomena accompanying the distribution of the working population into the different spheres of outlay of capital, according to its varying needs. The industrial reserve army, during the periods of stagnation and average prosperity, weighs down the active labour army. During the periods of overproduction and paroxysm, it holds its pretensions in check. Relative surplus population is therefore the pivot upon which the law of demand and supply of labour works. It confines the field of action of this law within the limits absolutely convenient to the activity of exploitation and to the domination of capital. This is the place to return to one of the grand exploits of economic apologetics. It will be remembered that if through the introduction of new or the extension of old machinery, a portion of variable capital is transformed into constant, the economic apologist interprets this operation which fixes capital, and by that very act sets labourers free, in exactly the opposite way, pretending that it sets free capital for the labourers. Only now can one fully understand the effrontery of these apologists. What are set free are not only the labourers immediately turned out by the machines, but also their future substitutes in the rising generation, the additional contingent that, with the usual extension of trade on the old basis, would be regularly absorbed. They are now all set free, and every new bit of capital looking out for employment can dispose of them. Whether it attracts them or others, the effect on the general labour demand will be nil, if this capital is just sufficient to take out of the market as many labourers as the machines threw upon it. If it employs a smaller number, that of the supernumeraries increases. If it employs a greater, the general demand for labour only increases to the extent of the excess of the employed over those set free. The impulse that additional capital, seeking an outlet, would otherwise have given to the general demand for labour, is therefore in every case neutralised to the extent of the labourers thrown out of employment by the machine. That is to say, the mechanism of capitalistic production so manages matters that the absolute increase of capital is accompanied by no corresponding rise in the general demand for labour. And this the apologist calls a compensation for the misery, the sufferings, the possible death of the displaced labourers during the transition period that banishes them into the industrial reserve army. The demand for labour is not identical with the increase of capital, nor supply of labour with increase of the working class. It is not a case of two independent forces working on one another. Les deux sont pipés. Capital works on both sides at the same time. If its accumulation, on the one hand, increases the demand for labour, it increases, on the other, the supply of labourers by the setting free of them, whilst at the same time the pressure of the unemployed compels those that are employed to furnish more labour, and therefore makes the supply of labour, to a certain extent, independent of the supply of labourers. The action of the law of supply and demand of labour on this basis completes the despotism of capital. As soon, therefore, as the labourers learn the secret, how it comes to pass that in the same measure as they work more, as they produce more wealth for others, and as the productive power of their labour increases, so, in the same measure, even their function as a means of the self-expansion of capital becomes more and more precarious for them. As soon as they discover that the degree of intensity of the competition among themselves depends wholly on the pressure of the relative surplus population, as soon as by trades unions, etc., they try to organize a regular cooperation between employed and unemployed in order to destroy or to weaken the ruinous effects of this natural law of capitalistic production on their class, so soon capital and its sycophant political economy cry out at the infringement of the eternal and, so to say, sacred law of supply and demand. Every combination of employed and unemployed disturbs the harmonious action of this law. But on the other hand, as soon as, in the colonies, for example, adverse circumstances prevent the creation of an industrial reserve army, and with it the absolute dependence of the working class upon the capitalist class, capital, along with its commonplace Sancho Panza, rebels against the sacred law of supply and demand, and tries to check its inconvenient action by forcible means and state interference. Section 4. Different forms of the relative surplus population. The general law of capitalistic accumulation. The relative surplus population exists in every possible form. Every laborer belongs to it during the time when he is only partially employed or wholly unemployed. Not taking into account the great periodically recurring forms that the changing phases of the industrial cycle impress on it, now an acute form during the crisis, then again a chronic form during dull times, it has always three forms: the floating, the latent, the stagnant. In the centres of modern industry, factories, manufactures, ironworks, mines, etc., the labourers are sometimes repelled, sometimes attracted again in greater masses, the number of those employed increasing on the whole, although in a constantly decreasing proportion to the scale of production. Here the surplus population exists in the floating form. In the automatic factories, as in all the great workshops where machinery enters as a factor, or where only the modern division of labour is carried out, large numbers of boys are employed up to the age of maturity. When this term is once reached, only a very small number continue to find employment in the same branches of industry, whilst the majority are regularly discharged. This majority forms an element of the floating surplus population, growing with the extension of those branches of industry. Part of them emigrates, following, in fact, capital that has emigrated. One consequence is that the female population grows more rapidly than the male. Teste, England. That the natural increase of the number of labourers does not satisfy the requirements of the accumulation of capital, and yet all the time is in excess of them, is a contradiction inherent to the movement of capital itself. It wants larger numbers of youthful labourers, a smaller number of adults. The contradiction is not more glaring than that other one, that there is a complaint of the want of hands, while at the same time many thousands are out of work, because the division of labour chains them to a particular branch of industry. Footnote. Whilst during the last 6 months of 1866, 80,000 to 90,000 working people in London were thrown out of work, the factory report for that same half-year says, "It does not appear absolutely true to say that demand will always produce supply just at the moment when it is needed. It has not done so with labour, for much machinery has been idle last year for want of hands." Report of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1866. End of footnote. The consumption of labour power by capital is, besides, so rapid that the labourer, halfway through his life, has already more or less completely lived himself out. He falls into the ranks of the supernumeraries, or is thrust down from a higher to a lower step in the scale. It is precisely among the workpeople of modern industry that we meet with the shortest duration of life. Dr. Lee, Medical Officer of Health for Manchester, stated that the average age at death of the Manchester upper middle class was 38 years, while the average age at death of the labouring class was 17. While at Liverpool, those figures were represented as 35 against 15. It thus appeared that the well-to-do classes had a lease of life which was more than double the value of that which fell to the lot of the less favoured citizens. Footnote. Opening address to the Sanitary Conference, Birmingham, January the 15th, 1875, by J. Chamberlain, Mayor of the town, now, 1883, President of the Board of Trade. End of footnote. In order to conform to these circumstances, the absolute increase of this section of the proletariat must take place under conditions that shall swell their numbers, although the individual elements are used up rapidly. Hence, rapid renewal of the generations of labourers. This law does not hold for the other classes of the population. This social need is met by early marriages, a necessary consequence of the conditions in which the labourers of modern industry live, and by the premium that the exploitation of children sets on their production. As soon as capitalist production takes possession of agriculture, and in proportion to the extent to which it does so, the demand for an agricultural labouring population falls absolutely, while the accumulation of the capital employed in agriculture advances without this repulsion being, as in non-agricultural industries, compensated by a greater attraction. Part of the agricultural population is therefore constantly on the point of passing over into an urban or manufacturing proletariat, and on the lookout for circumstances favourable to this transformation. Manufacture is used here in the sense of all non-agricultural industries. Footnote. 781 towns given in the census for 1861 for England and Wales contained 10,960,998 inhabitants, while the villages and country parishes contained 9,105,226. In 1851, 580 towns were distinguished, and the population in them and the surrounding country was nearly equal. But while in the subsequent 10 years the population in the villages and the country increased 500,000, the population in the 580 towns increased by 1.5 million, to 1,554,067. The increase of the population of the country parishes is 6.5%, and of the towns, 17.3%. The difference in the rates of increase is due to the migration from country to town. 3/4 of the total increase of population has taken place in the towns. Census, etc. End of footnote. The source of relative surplus population is thus constantly flowing, but the constant flow towards the town presupposes, in the country itself, a constant latent surplus population, the extent of which becomes evident only when its channels of outlet open to exceptional width. The agricultural labourer is therefore reduced to the minimum of wages, and always stands with one foot already in the swamp of pauperism. The third category of the relative surplus population, the stagnant, forms a part of the active labour army, but with extremely irregular employment. Hence it furnishes to capital an inexhaustible reservoir of disposable labour power. Its conditions of life sink below the average normal level of the working class. This makes it at once the broad basis of special branches of capitalist exploitation. It is characterized by maximum of working time and minimum of wages. we have learned to know its chief form under the rubric of domestic industry. It recruits itself constantly from the supernumerary forces of modern industry and agriculture, and specially from those decaying branches of industry where handicraft is yielding to manufacture, manufacture to machinery. Its extent grows as, with the extent and energy of accumulation, the creation of a surplus population advances. But it forms at the same time a self-reproducing and self-perpetuating element of the working class, taking a proportionally greater part in the general increase of that class than the other elements. In fact, not only the number of births and deaths, but the absolute size of the families stand in inverse proportion to the height of wages, and therefore to the amount of means of subsistence of which the different categories of labourers dispose. This law of capitalistic society would sound absurd to savages, or even civilized colonists. It calls to mind the boundless reproduction of animals individually weak and constantly hunted down. Footnote. Poverty seems favourable to generation. A. Smith. This is even a specially wise arrangement of God, according to the gallant and witty Abbe Galiani. God ordains that men who carry on trades of primary utility are born in abundance. Galiani. Misery up to the extreme point of famine and pestilence, instead of checking, tends to increase population. S. Lang, National Distress, 1844. After Lang has illustrated this by statistics, he continues, "If the people were all in easy circumstances, the world would soon be depopulated." End of footnote. The lowest sediment of the relative surplus population finally dwells in the sphere of pauperism. Exclusive of vagabonds, criminals, prostitutes, in a word, the dangerous classes, this layer of society consists of three categories. First, those able to work. One need only glance superficially at the statistics of English pauperism to find that the quantity of paupers increases with every crisis and diminishes with every revival of trade. Second, orphans and pauper children. These are candidates for the industrial reserve army, and are, in times of great prosperity, as 1860, for example, speedily and in large numbers enrolled in the active army of labourers. Third, the demoralised and ragged, and those unable to work, chiefly people who succumb to their incapacity for adaptation due to the division of labour, people who have passed the normal age of the labourer, the victims of industry, whose number increases with the increase of dangerous machinery, of mines, chemical works, etc., the mutilated, the sickly, the widows, etc. Pauperism is the hospital of the active labour army and the dead weight of the industrial reserve army. Its production is included in that of the relative surplus population, its necessity in theirs. Along with the surplus population, pauperism forms a condition of capitalist production and of the capitalist development of wealth. It enters into the faux frais of capitalist production. But capital knows how to throw these, for the most part, from its own shoulders onto those of the working class and the lower middle class. The greater the social wealth, the functioning capital, the extent and energy of its growth, and therefore also the absolute mass of the proletariat and the productiveness of its labour, the greater is the industrial reserve army. The same causes which develop the expansive power of capital develop also the labour power at its disposal. The relative mass of the industrial reserve army increases, therefore, with the potential energy of wealth. But the greater this reserve army in proportion to the active labour army, the greater is the mass of a consolidated surplus population, whose misery is in inverse ratio to its torment of labour. The more extensive, finally, the Lazarus layers of the working class and the industrial reserve army, the greater is official pauperism. This is the absolute general law of capitalist accumulation. Like all other laws, it is modified in its working by many circumstances, the analysis of which does not concern us here. The folly is now patent of the economic wisdom that preaches to the labourers the accommodation of their number to the requirements of capital. The mechanism of capitalist production and accumulation constantly effects this adjustment. The first word of this adaptation is the creation of a relative surplus population, or industrial reserve army. Its last word is the misery of constantly extending strata of the active army of labour and the dead weight of pauperism. The law by which a constantly increasing quantity of means of production, thanks to the advance in the productiveness of social labour, may be set in movement by a progressively diminishing expenditure of human power. This law, in a capitalist society, where the labourer does not employ the means of production but the means of production employ the labourer, undergoes a complete inversion and is expressed thus. The higher the productiveness of labour, the greater is the pressure of the labourers on the means of employment, the more precarious, therefore, becomes their condition of existence, viz. The sale of their own labour power for the increasing of another's wealth, or for the self-expansion of capital. The fact that the means of production and the productiveness of labour increase more rapidly than the productive population expresses itself, therefore, capitalistically, in the inverse form that the labouring population always increases more rapidly than the conditions under which capital can employ this increase for its own self-expansion. We saw in Part 4, when analysing the production of relative surplus value, within the capitalist system, all methods for raising the social productiveness of labour are brought about at the cost of the individual labourer. All means for the development of production transform themselves into means of domination over and exploitation of the producers. They mutilate the labourer into a fragment of a man, degrade him to the level of an appendage of a machine, destroy every remnant of charm in his work, and turn it into a hated toil. They estrange from him the intellectual potentialities of the labour process in the same proportion as science is incorporated in it as an independent power. They distort the conditions under which he works, subject him during the labour process to a despotism the more hateful for its meanness. They transform his lifetime into working time, and drag his wife and child beneath the wheels of the juggernaut of capital. But all methods for the production of surplus value are at the same time methods of accumulation, and every extension of accumulation becomes again a means for the development of those methods. It follows, therefore, that in proportion as capital accumulates, the lot of the labourer, be his payment high or low, must grow worse. The law, finally, that always equilibrates the relative surplus population or industrial reserve army to the extent and energy of accumulation, this law rivets the labourer to capital more firmly than the wedges of Vulcan did Prometheus to the rock. It establishes an accumulation of misery corresponding with accumulation of capital. Accumulation of wealth at one pole, is therefore at the same time accumulation of misery, agony of toil, slavery, ignorance, brutality, mental degradation, at the opposite pole, that is, on the side of the class that produces its own product in the form of capital. Footnote. From day to day it thus becomes clearer that the production relations in which the bourgeoisie moves have not a simple uniform character, but a dual character, that in the self-same relations in which wealth is produced, poverty is produced also, that in the self-same relations in which there is a development of productive forces, there is also a force producing repression, that there relations produce bourgeois wealth, that is, the wealth of the bourgeois class, only by continually annihilating the wealth of the individual members of this class and by producing an ever-growing proletariat. Karl Marx, Misère de la philosophie. End of footnote. This antagonistic character of capitalistic accumulation is enunciated in various forms by political economists, although by them it is confounded with phenomena, certainly to some extent analogous, but nevertheless essentially distinct, and belonging to pre-capitalistic modes of production. The Venetian monk Orthez, one of the great economic writers of the 18th century, regards the antagonism of capitalist production as a general natural law of social wealth. In the economy of a nation, advantages and evils always balance one another. The abundance of wealth with some people is always equal to the want of it with others. The great riches of a small number are always accompanied by the absolute privation of the first necessaries of life for many others. The wealth of a nation corresponds with its population, and its misery corresponds with its wealth. Diligence in some compels idleness in others. The poor and idle are a necessary consequence of the rich and active, etc. Footnote. G. Orthez, Delia Economia Nazionale Libri Sei, 1777, in Custodi Parte Moderna. Orthez says, instead of projecting useless systems for achieving the happiness of people, I shall limit myself to investigating the reasons for their unhappiness. End of footnote. In a thoroughly brutal way, about 10 years after Orthez, the Church of England Parson Townsend glorified misery as a necessary condition of wealth. Legal constraint to labour is attended with too much trouble, violence, and noise, whereas hunger is not only a peaceable, silent, unremitted pressure, but as the most natural motive to industry and labour, it calls forth the most powerful exertions. Everything, therefore, depends upon making hunger permanent among the working class, and for this, according to Townsend, the principle of population, especially active among the poor, provides. It seems to be a law of nature that the poor should be to a certain degree improvident, that is, so improvident as to be born without a silver spoon in the mouth, that there may always be some to fulfil the most servile, the most sordid, and the most ignoble offices in the community. The stock of human happiness is thereby much increased, whilst the more delicate are not only relieved from drudgery, but are left at liberty without interruption to pursue those callings which are suited to their various dispositions. It, the poor law, tends to destroy the harmony and beauty, the symmetry and order of that system which God and nature have established in the world. Footnote. A dissertation on the poor laws by a well-wisher of mankind, the Reverend J. Townsend, 1786, republished London, 1817. This delicate parson, from whose work just quoted, as well as from his journey through Spain, Malthus often copies whole pages, himself borrowed the greater part of his doctrine from Sir James Stuart, whom he, however, alters in the borrowing. For example, when Stuart says, "Here, in slavery, was a forcible method of making mankind diligent, for the non-workers. Men were then forced to work, that is, to work gratis for others, because they were slaves of others. Men are now forced to work, that is, to work gratis for non-workers, because they are the slaves of their necessities." He does not thence conclude, like the fat holder of benefices, that the wage labourer must always go fasting. He wishes, on the contrary, to increase their wants and to make the increasing number of their wants a stimulus to their labour for the more delicate. End of footnote. If the Venetian monk found, in the fatal destiny that makes misery eternal, the raison d'être of Christian charity, celibacy, monasteries, and holy houses, the Protestant prebendary finds in it a pretext for condemning the laws in virtue of which the poor possessed a right to a miserable public relief. The progress of social wealth, says Storch, begets this useful class of society, which performs the most wearisome, the vilest, the most disgusting functions, which takes, in a word, on its shoulders all that is disagreeable and servile in life, and procures thus, for other classes, leisure, serenity of mind, and conventional, c'est bon, dignity of character. Storch asks himself, in what then really consists the progress of this capitalistic civilization, with its misery and its degradation of the masses, as compared with barbarism? He finds but one answer: security. Thanks to the advance of industry and science, says Sismondi, every labourer can produce every day much more than his consumption requires. But at the same time, whilst his labour produces wealth, that wealth would, were he called on to consume it himself, make him less fit for labour. According to him, men, that is, non-workers, would probably prefer to do without all artistic perfection and all the enjoyments that manufacturers procure for us, if it were necessary that all should buy them by constant toil like that of the labourer. Exertion today is separated from its recompense. It is not the same man that first works and then reposes, but it is because the one works that the other rests. The indefinite multiplication of the productive powers of labour can then only have for result the increase of luxury and enjoyment of the idle rich. Finally, Destout de Tracy, the fish-blooded bourgeois doctrinaire, blurts out brutally, "In poor nations the people are comfortable, in rich nations they are generally poor." Section 5. Illustrations of the General Law of Capitalist Accumulation. A. England, from 1846 to 1866. No period of modern society is so favourable for the study of capitalist accumulation as the period of the last 20 years. It is as if this period had found Fortunatus's purse. But of all countries, England again furnishes the classical example, because it holds the foremost place in the world market, because capitalist production is here alone completely developed, and lastly, because the introduction of the free trade millennium since 1846 has cut off the last retreat of vulgar economy. The titanic advance of production, the latter half of the 20 years period again far surpassing the former, has been already pointed out sufficiently in Part 4. Although the absolute increase of the English population in the last half century was very great, the relative increase, or rate of growth, fell constantly, as the following figures, borrowed from the census, show. Annual increase percent of the population of England and Wales in decimal numbers. 1811 to 1821, 1.533%. 1821 to 1831, 1.446%. 1831 to 1841, 1.326%. 1841 to 1851, 1.216%. 1851 to 1861, 1.141%. Let us now, on the other hand, consider the increase of wealth. Here, the movement of profit, rent of land, etc., that come under the income tax, furnishes the surest basis. The increase of profits liable to income tax, farmers and some other categories not included, in Great Britain from 1853 to 1864, amounted to 50.47%, or 4.58% as the annual average, that of the population during the same period to about 12%. Footnote. 10th Report of the Commissioners of H.M. Inland Revenue, 1866. End of footnote. The augmentation of the rent of land subject to taxation, including houses, railways, mines, fisheries, etc., amounted for 1853 to 1864 to 38%, or 3 5/12% annually. Under this head, the following categories show the greatest increase. Excess of annual income of 1864 over that of 1853. Increase per year. Houses, 3.5%. Quarries, 7.70%. Mines, 6.26%. Ironworks, 3.63%. Fisheries, 5.21%. Gasworks, 11.45%. Railways, 7.57%. If we compare the years from 1853 to 1864 in three sets of four consecutive years each, the rate of augmentation of the income increases constantly. It is, for example, for that arising from profits between 1853 to 1857, 1.73% yearly. 1857 to 1861, 2.74%, and for 1861 to 64, 9.30% yearly. The sum of the incomes of the United Kingdom that come under the income tax was, in 1856, £307,068,898. In 1859, £328,127,416. In 1862, £351,745,241. In 1863, £359,142,897. In 1864, £362,462,279. In 1865, £385,530,020. Footnote. These figures are sufficient for comparison, but taken absolutely are false, since perhaps £100 million of income are annually not declared. The complaints of the Inland Revenue Commissioners of systematic fraud, especially on the part of the commercial and industrial classes, are repeated in each of their reports. So, for example, a joint stock company returns £6,000 as assessable profits. The surveyor raises the amount to £88,000, and upon that sum, duty is ultimately paid. Another company, which returns £190,000, is finally compelled to admit that the true return should be £250,000. End of footnote. The accumulation of capital was attended at the same time by its concentration and centralization. Although no official statistics of agriculture existed for England, they did for Ireland, they were voluntarily given in 10 counties. These statistics gave the result that from 1851 to 1861, the number of farms of less than 100 acres had fallen from 31,583 to 26,597, so that 5,016 had been thrown together into larger farms. Footnote. Census, etc. John Bright's assertion that 150 landlords own half of England and 12 half the Scotch soil has never been refuted. End of footnote. From 1815 to 1825, no personal estate of more than £1 million came under the succession duty. From 1825 to 1855, however, 8 did, and 4 from 1856 to June 1859, that is, in 4.5 years. Footnote. Fourth report, etc., of Inland Revenue, 1860, end of footnote. The centralisation will, however, be best seen from a shorter analysis of the Income Tax Schedule D, profits, exclusive of farms, etc., in the years 1864 and 1865. I note beforehand that incomes from this source pay income tax on everything over £60. These incomes, liable to taxation in England, Wales and Scotland, amounted in 1864 to £95,844,224, in 1865 to £105,435,579. Footnote. These are the net incomes after certain legally authorised abatements. End of footnotes. The number of persons taxed were, in 1864, 308,416, out of a population of 23,891,009. In 1865, 332,431, out of a population of 24,127,003. In 1855, there were produced in the United Kingdom 61,453,079 tons of coal, of value 16,113,167 pounds. In 1864, 92,787,873 tons, of value 23,197,968 pounds. In 1855, 3,218,154 tons of pig iron, of value 8,045,385 pounds. 1864, 4,767,951 tons, of value 11,919,877 pounds. In 1854, the length of the railroads worked in the United Kingdom was 8,054 miles, with a paid-up capital of 286,068,794 pounds. In 1864, the length was 12,789 miles, with capital paid up of 425,719,613 pounds. In 1854, the total sum of the exports and imports of the United Kingdom was 268,210,145 pounds. In 1865, 489,923,285. The following figures show the movements of the exports alone. 1846, 58,842,377 pounds. 1849, £63,596,052. 1856, £115,826,948. 1860, £135,842,817. 1865, £165,862,402. 1866, £188,917,563. Footnote. At this moment, March 1867, the Indian and Chinese market is again overstocked by the consignments of the British cotton manufacturers. In 1866, a reduction in wages of 5% took place amongst the cotton operatives. In 1867, as consequence of a similar operation, there was a strike of 20,000 men at Preston. Added in the fourth German edition, that was the prelude to the crisis which broke out immediately afterwards. Friedrich Engels, end of footnote. After these few examples, one understands the cry of triumph of the Registrar General of the British people. Rapidly as the population has increased, it has not kept pace with the progress of industry and wealth. Footnote. Census, etc. End of footnote. Let us turn now to the direct agents of this industry, or the producers of this wealth, to the working class.
"It is one of the most melancholy features in the social state of this country," says Gladstone, "that while there was a decrease in the consuming powers of the people, and while there was an increase in the privations and distress of the labouring class and operatives, there was at the same time a constant accumulation of wealth in the upper classes and a constant increase of capital." Footnote. Gladstone in the House of Commons, February 13, 1843. Times, February 14, 1843. "It is one of the most melancholy features in the social state of this country that we see, beyond the possibility of denial, that while there is at this moment a decrease in the consuming powers of the people, an increase of the pressure of privations and distress, there is at the same time a constant accumulation of wealth in the upper classes, an increase of the luxuriousness of their habits and of their means of enjoyment." Hansard, 13th of February, end of footnote. Thus spake this unctuous minister in the House of Commons of February the 13th, 1843. On April the 16th, 1863, 20 years later, in the speech in which he introduced his budget, "From 1842 to 1852, the taxable income of the country increased by 6%. In the 8 years from 1853 to 1861, it had increased from the basis taken in 1853 by 20%. The fact is so astonishing as to be almost incredible. This intoxicating augmentation of wealth and power, entirely confined to classes of property, must be of indirect benefit to the labouring population, because it cheapens the commodities of general consumption. While the rich have been growing richer, the poor have been growing less poor. At any rate, whether the extremes of poverty are less, I do not presume to say."
How lame an anticlimax! If the working class has remained poor, only less poor in proportion as it produces for the wealthy class an intoxicating augmentation of wealth and power, then it has remained relatively just as poor. If the extremes of poverty have not lessened, they have increased, because the extremes of wealth have. As to the cheapening of the means of subsistence, the official statistics, for example, the accounts of the London Orphan Asylum, show an increase in price of 20% for the average of the 3 years 1860 to 1862, compared with 1851 to 1853. In the following 3 years, 1863 to 1865, there was a progressive rise in the price of meat, butter, milk, sugar, salt, coals, and a number of other necessary means of subsistence. Footnote. See the official accounts in the Blue Book, Miscellaneous Statistics of the United Kingdom, 1866. Instead of the statistics of orphan asylums, etc., the declamations of the ministerial journals in recommending dowries for the royal children might also serve. The greater dearness of the means of subsistence is never forgotten there. End of footnote. Gladstone's next budget speech of April the 7th, 1864, is a Pindaric dithyrambus on the advance of surplus value-making and the happiness of the people tempered by poverty. He speaks of masses on the border of pauperism, of branches of trade in which wages have not increased, and finally sums up the happiness of the working class in the words, "Human life is but, in 9 cases out of 10, a struggle for existence." Footnote. Gladstone, House of Commons, 7th of April, 1864. The Hansard version runs, "Again, and yet more at large, what is human life but in the majority of cases a struggle for existence?" The continual crying contradictions in Gladstone's budget speeches of 1863 and 1864 were characterized by an English writer by the following quotation from Boileau. "Such is the man. He goes from black to white. He condemns in the morning what he felt in the evening, a nuisance to everyone else and an inconvenience to himself. He changes his way of thinking as easily as he changes his way of dressing." The Theory of Exchanges, etc., London, 1864. End of footnote. Professor Fawcett, not bound, like Gladstone, by official considerations, declares roundly, "I do not, of course, deny that money wages have been augmented by this increase of capital in the last 10 years, but this apparent advantage is to a great extent lost, because many of the necessaries of life are becoming dearer," he believes because of the fall in the value of the precious metals. "The rich grow rapidly richer, whilst there is no perceptible advance in the comfort enjoyed by the industrial classes. They, the labourers, become almost the slaves of the tradesmen to whom they owe money." Footnote. H. Fawcett. "As to the increasing dependence of labourers on the retail shopkeepers, this is the consequence of the frequent oscillations and interruptions of their employment." End of footnote. In the chapters on the working day and machinery, the listener has heard under what circumstances the British working class created an intoxicating augmentation of wealth and power for the propertied classes. There we were chiefly concerned with the social functioning of the labourer. But for a full elucidation of the law of accumulation, his condition outside the workshop must also be looked at, his condition as to food and dwelling. The limits of this book compel us to concern ourselves chiefly with the worst paid part of the industrial proletariat, and with the agricultural labourers, who together form the majority of the working class. But first, one word on official pauperism, or on that part of the working class which has forfeited its condition of existence, the sale of labour power, and vegetates upon public alms. The official list of paupers numbered in England in 1885 851,369 persons. Wales here is always included in England. In 1856, 877,767. In 1865, 971,433. In consequence of the cotton famine, it grew in the years 1863 and 1864 to 1,079,382 and 1,014,978. The crisis of 1866, which fell most heavily on London, created in this centre of the world market, more populous than the Kingdom of Scotland, an increase of pauperism for the year 1866 of 19.5%, compared with 1865, and of 24.4% compared with 1864, and a still greater increase for the first months of 1867 as compared with 1866. From the analysis of the statistics of pauperism, 2 points are to be taken. On the one hand, the fluctuation up and down of the number of paupers reflects the periodic changes of the industrial cycle. On the other, the official statistics become more and more misleading as to the actual extent of pauperism in proportion as, with the accumulation of capital, the class struggle and therefore the class consciousness of the working men develop. For example, the barbarity in the treatment of the paupers at which the English press, the Times, Pall Mall Gazette, etc., have cried out so loudly during the last 2 years, is of ancient date. Friedrich Engels showed in 1844 exactly the same horrors, exactly the same transient, canting outcries of sensational literature. But frightful increase of death by starvation in London during the last 10 years proves beyond doubt the growing horror in which the working people hold the slavery of the workhouse, that place of punishment for misery. Footnote. A peculiar light is thrown on the advance made since the time of Adam Smith by the fact that by him the word workhouse is still occasionally used as synonymous with manufactory. For example, the opening of his chapter on the division of labour. Those employed in every different branch of the work can often be collected into the same workhouse. End of footnote. B. The badly paid strata of the British industrial class. During the cotton famine of 1862, Dr. Smith was charged by the Privy Council with an inquiry into the conditions of nourishment of the distressed operatives in Lancashire and Cheshire. His observations during many preceding years had led him to the conclusion that, to avert starvation diseases, the daily food of an average woman ought to contain at least 3,900 grains of carbon with 180 grains of nitrogen. The daily food of an average man, at least 4,300 grains of carbon with 200 grains of nitrogen. For women, about the same quantity of nutritive elements as are contained in 2 pounds of good wheaten bread. For men, 1/9 more. For the weekly average of adult men and women, at least 28,600 grains of carbon and 1,330 grains of nitrogen. His calculation was practically confirmed in a surprising manner by its agreement with the miserable quantity of nourishment to which want had forced down the consumption of the cotton operatives. This was, in December 1862, 29,211 grains of carbon and 1,295 grains of nitrogen weekly. In the year 1863, the Privy Council ordered an inquiry into the state of distress of the worst nourished part of the English working class. Dr. Simon, medical officer to the Privy Council, chose for this work the above-mentioned Dr. Smith. His inquiry ranges on the one hand over the agricultural labourers, on the other over silk weavers, needlewomen, kid glovers, stocking weavers, glove weavers, and shoemakers. The latter categories are, with the exception of the stocking weavers, exclusively town dwellers. It was made a rule in the inquiry to select in each category the most healthy families, and those comparatively in the best circumstances. As a general result, it was found that in only one of the examined classes of indoor operatives did the average nitrogen supply just exceed, while in another it nearly reached, the estimated standard of bare sufficiency, that is, sufficient to avert starvation diseases, and that in two classes there was defect, in one a very large defect, of both nitrogen and carbon. Moreover, as regards the examined families of the agricultural population, it appeared that more than a fifth were with less than the estimated sufficiency of carbonaceous food, that more than one-third were with less than the estimated sufficiency of nitrogenous food, and that in three counties, Berkshire, Oxfordshire and Somersetshire, insufficiency of nitrogenous food was the average local diet. Footnote. Public Health, 6th Report, 1864. End of footnote. Among the agricultural labourers, those of England, the wealthiest part of the United Kingdom, were the worst fed. The insufficiency of food among the agricultural labourers fell, as a rule, chiefly on the women and children, for the man must eat to do his work. Still greater penury ravaged the town workers examined. They are so ill-fed that assuredly among them there must be many cases of severe and injurious privation. Privation of the capitalist, all this. That is, abstinence from paying for the means of subsistence absolutely necessary for the mere vegetation of his hands. The following figures show the conditions of nourishment of the above-named categories of purely town-dwelling workpeople as compared with the minimum assumed by Dr. Smith and with the food allowance of the cotton operatives during the time of their greatest distress. Both sexes. 5 indoor occupations, average weekly carbon 28,876 grains, average weekly nitrogen 1,192 grains. Unemployed Lancashire operatives, average weekly carbon 28,211 grains, average weekly nitrogen 1,295 grains. Minimum quantity to be allowed to the Lancashire operatives, equal number of males and females, weekly carbon, 28,600 grains, weekly nitrogen, 1,330 grains. One-half, or 60/125, of the industrial labour categories investigated had absolutely no beer, 28% no milk. The weekly average of the liquid means of nourishment in the families varied from 7 ounces in the needle women to 24¾ ounces in the stocking makers. The majority of those who did not obtain milk were needle women in London. The quantity of breadstuffs consumed weekly varied from 7¾ pounds for the needle women to 11½ pounds for the shoemakers, and gave a total average of 9.9 pounds per adult weekly. Sugar, treacle, etc., varied from 4 ounces weekly for the kid glovers to 11 ounces for the stocking makers, and the total average per week for all categories was 8 ounces per adult weekly. Total weekly average of butter, fat, etc., 5 ounces per adult. The weekly average of meat, bacon, etc., varied from 7¼ ounces for the silk weavers to 18¼ ounces for the kid glovers. Total average for the different categories, 13.6 ounces. The weekly cost of food per adult gave the following average figures. Silk weavers, 2 shillings 2½ pence. Needle women, 2 shillings and 7 pence. Kid glovers, 2 shillings 9½ pence, shoemakers 2 shillings 7¾ pence, stocking weavers 2 shillings 6¼ pence. For the silk weavers of Macclesfield, the average was only 1 shilling 8½ pence. The worst categories were the needlewomen, silk weavers, and kid glovers. Of these facts, Dr. Simon, in his general health report, says that cases are innumerable in which defective diet is the cause or the aggravator of disease can be affirmed by anyone who is conversant with poor law medical practice or with the wards and outpatient rooms of hospitals. Yet, in this point of view, there is, in my opinion, a very important sanitary context to be added. It must be remembered that privation of food is very reluctantly borne, and that as a rule great poorness of diet will only come when other privations have preceded it. Long before insufficiency of diet is a matter of hygienic concern, long before the physiologist would think of counting the grains of nitrogen and carbon which intervene between life and starvation, the household will have been utterly destitute of material comfort. Clothing and fuel will have been even scantier than food. Against inclemencies of weather, there will have been no adequate protection. Dwelling space will have been stinted to the degree in which overcrowding produces or increases disease. Of household utensils and furniture, there will have been scarcely any. Even cleanliness will have been found costly or difficult, and if there still be self-respectful endeavours to maintain it, every such endeavour will represent additional pangs of hunger. The home, too, will be where shelter can be cheapest bought. In quarters where commonly there is least fruit of sanitary supervision, least drainage, least scavenging, least suppression of public nuisances, least or worst water supply, and if in town, least light and air. Such are the sanitary dangers to which poverty is almost certainly exposed, when it is poverty enough to imply scantiness of food. And while the sum of them is of terrible magnitude against life, the mere scantiness of food is in itself of very serious moment. These are painful reflections, especially when it is remembered that the poverty to which they advert is not the deserved poverty of idleness. In all cases, it is the poverty of working populations. Indeed, as regards the indoor operatives, the work which obtains the scanty pittance of food is for the most part excessively prolonged. Yet evidently it is only in a qualified sense that the work can be deemed self-supporting. And on a very large scale the nominal self-support can be only a circuit, longer or shorter, to pauperism. The intimate connection between the pangs of hunger of the most industrious layers of the working class and the extravagant consumption, coarse or refined, of the rich, for which capitalist accumulation is the basis, reveals itself only when the economic laws are known. It is otherwise with the housing of the poor. Every unprejudiced observer sees that the greater the centralization of the means of production, the greater is the corresponding heaping together of the laborers within a given space, that therefore the swifter capitalistic accumulation, the more miserable are the dwellings of the working people. Improvements of towns accompanying the increase of wealth, by the demolition of badly built quarters, the erection of palaces for banks, warehouses, etc., the widening of streets for business traffic, for the carriages of luxury, and for the introduction of tramways, etc., drive away the poor into even worse and more crowded hiding places. On the other hand, everyone knows that the dearness of dwellings is in inverse ratio to their excellence, and that the mines of misery are exploited by house speculators with more profit or less cost than ever were the mines of Potosi. The antagonistic character of capitalist accumulation, and therefore of the capitalistic relations of property generally, is here so evident that even the official English reports on this subject teem with heterodox onslaughts on property and its rights. Footnote. In no particular have the rights of persons been so avowedly and shamefully sacrificed to the rights of property, as in regard to the lodging of the labouring class. Every large town may be looked upon as a place of human sacrifice, a shrine where thousands pass yearly through the fire as offerings to the Moloch of avarice. S. Lang. End of footnote. With the development of industry, with the accumulation of capital, with the growth and improvement of towns, the evil makes such progress that the mere fear of contagious diseases which do not spare even respectability, brought into existence from 1847 to 1864 no less than 10 Acts of Parliament on sanitation, and that the frightened bourgeois in some towns, as Liverpool, Glasgow, etc., took strenuous measures through their municipalities. Nevertheless, Dr. Simon, in his report of 1865, says, "Speaking generally, it may be said that the evils are uncontrolled in England." By order of the Privy Council in 1864, an inquiry was made into the conditions of the housing of the agricultural labourers. In 1865, of the poorer classes in the towns. The results of the admirable work of Dr. Julian Hunter are to be found in the 7th, 1865, and 8th, 1866, reports on public health. To the agricultural labourers I shall come later. On the condition of town dwellings, I quote, as preliminary, a general remark of Dr. Simon. "Although my official point of view," he says, "is one exclusively physical, common humanity requires that the other aspect of this evil should not be ignored. In its higher degrees, it, that is, overcrowding, almost necessarily involves such negation of all delicacy, such unclean confusion of bodies and bodily functions, such exposure of animal and sexual nakedness, as is rather bestial than human. To be subject to these influences is a degradation which must become deeper and deeper for those on whom it continues to work. To children who are born under its curse, it must often be a very baptism into infamy, and beyond all measure hopeless is the wish that persons thus circumstanced should ever in other respects aspire to that atmosphere of civilization which has its essence in physical and moral cleanliness." Footnote. Public Health, 8th Report, 1866. End of footnote. London takes the first place in overcrowded habitations, absolutely unfit for human beings. "He feels clear," says Dr. Hunter, "on two points. First, that there are about 20 large colonies in London of about 10,000 persons each, whose miserable condition exceeds almost anything he has seen elsewhere in England, and is almost entirely the result of their bad house accommodation. And second, that the crowded and dilapidated condition of the houses of these colonies is much worse than was the case 20 years ago. It is not too much to say that life in parts of London and Newcastle is infernal." Footnote. With reference to the children in these colonies, Dr. Hunter says, "People are not now alive to tell us how children were brought up before this age of dense agglomerations of poor began, and he would be a rash prophet who should tell us what future behaviour is to be expected from the present growth of children, who, under circumstances probably never before paralleled in this country, are now completing their education for future practice as dangerous classes, by sitting up half the night with persons of every age, half-naked, drunken, obscene, and quarrelsome." End of footnote. Further, the better-off part of the working class, together with the small shopkeepers and other elements of the lower middle class, falls in London more and more under the curse of these vile conditions of dwelling, in proportion as improvements, and with them the demolition of old streets and houses, advance, as factories and the afflux of human beings grow in the metropolis, and finally as house rents rise with the ground rents. Rents have become so heavy that few labouring men can afford more than one room. Footnote. Report of the Officer of Health of St. Martin's in the Fields, 1865. End of footnote. There is almost no house property in London that is not overburdened with a number of middlemen. For the price of land in London is always very high in comparison with its yearly revenue, and therefore every buyer speculates on getting rid of it again at a jury price, the expropriation valuation fixed by jurymen, or on pocketing an extraordinary increase of value arising from the neighbourhood of some large establishment. As a consequence of this, there is a regular trade in the purchase of fag ends of leases. Gentlemen in this